This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you after a fascinating hour with Congressman Mark Pocan. Let's move to another topic here. This, you know, the presidency, essentially. It's interesting how during the presidency of George W. Bush and just before it, we saw this major effort to conflate George W. Bush and his father's presidency with that of John Quincy Adams and John Adams. And, you know, to his credit, John Quincy Adams was arguably one of the most, you know, high-minded, ethical presidents and politicians of the 19th century, you know, of that entire era. And he was defeated by Andrew Jackson, who basically called him a limp-wristed wimp. John Quincy Adams was very educated, and he was very opposed to slavery, so much so that after he lost the presidential election and was no longer president, lost the election to Andrew Jackson, he ran for Congress and went back into the U.S. House of Representatives just so he could break the law and bring up the issue of slavery every single day. So anyhow, into this this modern maelstrom steps Bradley J. Berzer. He is a professor of history and the Russell Kirk Chair in American Studies. Russell Kirk, of course, the author of The Conservative Mind back in 1951, the book that kicked off the modern conservative movement. He's a co-founder and editor-at-large of The Imaginative Conservative. His website, Brad Berzer, BIRZER.com, and you can tweet him at Bradley Berzer at Hillsdale College. Dr. Berzer, welcome back to the welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Tom. I'm really glad to be here.
Thank you. You have written a book in defense of Andrew Jackson, and I'm just baffled by this. This guy was a hypocrite. He was a moral coward. He was a slave owner, and over the years, when he first bought the Hermitage, he had 10 slaves there. By the time he died, he had 150. He was in the business. He is a probable rapist. He was a fan of genocide. When he had taken New Orleans, he had people executed just because they upset him. How could anybody defend this man?
Oh yeah, thanks, Tom. I mean, there's so many things about Jackson that are problematic, if not downright wrong. And I think that's a fair assessment. Part of what I was trying to do with the in defense of, and I like John Quincy Adams as well. In fact, I think he's the best man of that era. But part of what I was trying to do is just kind of move beyond some of the stereotypes that have really grown since the 1960s regarding Jackson, especially in terms of his Indian policy, and try and give it a little bit of context. So I know the title is In Defense Of, but it's really more, let's see this guy in context and try and figure out what he was trying to do and how people responded to him.
So, for example, in 1830, he signed this law, the Indian Removal Act, which legalized ethnic cleansing. Within 7 years, 46,000 human beings were removed from their homelands east of the Mississippi. This gave 25 million acres to white settlement, which was virtually all turned over to cotton and slavery, which is exactly what he wanted. The Cherokee, the Creek, the Choctaw, the Chickasaw, the Seminoles. I mean, he declared war on the Seminoles. Just kind of basically, you know, made this war up. You know, how can you put that in any kind of context? You know, at the time, the previous president, John Quincy Adams, said what Andrew Jackson was doing was criminal.
Yeah, you know, again, it is hard to defend in so many ways. So part of the context, if I can think about this and try and think about it as objectively as possible, which is not always easy as a historian, but when we look at Jackson and the Indian Removal Act, obviously the consequences of that were just disastrous. And, you know, no more so, I think. I mean, the Choctaw prove how disastrous it was. The removal, they died, almost a third of the tribe died en route to Oklahoma. Another third, or at least a half of that remaining, died that first winter. Yeah, it was a bureaucratic nightmare in every way. And it would be so difficult to imagine being a survivor of that, you know, knowing that two out of every three of the people you know is gone. So I don't think there's a lot of justification for it. The only thing that I think is possible is to try and understand why Congress would have done this. Why did they go along with the president? How was he able to push this? And to me, the fascinating aspect is that really, as Jackson was promoting this, so many people in America at the time were actually blaming him for being too pro-Indian and being an Indian lover because he was spending so much money on the Indians and giving them what they considered to be prime land as opposed to giving
them his nicknames were Indian Killer and Sharp Knife. He was famous for killing Indians. I mean, that's what he did. Going after the Seminole, back before he was president, he ordered, after they attacked the men and beat them, he then ordered his soldiers to go in and burn the villages and murder the women and children so there would be no ancestors.
Yeah, I mean, there you've got an example of frontier total war at its worst. And Jackson, he did, to say that he was against all Indians would be taking it too far.
No, he adopted one, that's sort of like, saying, some of my best friends are Jewish or black or fill in the blanks. I mean, it doesn't really wash.
He did, though. Agreed. That could be taken in a lot of different ways. But he also allied himself with a number of Indians. And when we look at what he did at the Battle of New Orleans, he had a number of Indians fighting on his side. So it was never a clear-cut distinction between those who were Native and those who weren't. Jackson was pretty clear about the way that he thought in terms of who could be in alliance and who couldn't. And often those decisions were fairly moral decisions based on how the tribe had behaved or what they were doing.
But isn't this something that went back to Bradford in the 1620s of basically aligning with one tribe against another tribe to try and split them apart and then ultimately destroy both of them, even though you've got a temporary alliance with one tribe?
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty cynical interpretation of it.
But that's how it played out.
It's totally wrong.
I mean, that's how it played out. There's in large chunks of this country, there's no more Native Americans, and it used to be chock-a-block, right? Full.
You know, the other thing that I think, Tom, at least for me, that gives me a little bit of pause is it is true that so many Southerners benefited from the removal. That, again, I don't think we can question. I think that's obvious. But Jackson also went against Southern interests very strongly with the nullification process in 1832 and 1833. So if he really was just adamantly pro-Southern, he really shot himself in the foot in a lot of ways.
Well, he was adamantly pro-slavery, I think. But let's take this to today. One of the things that I find fascinating,
sure,
about, we're talking with Bradley Berzer. He's got a new book out called In Defense of Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson is Donald Trump's favorite president. And, I don't know why. I don't, know if it's because Andrew Jackson was a famous racist or because he killed so many Indians or because he owned so many slaves. I don't get it. But, he gave lip service to small government, but that's not certainly what he did. What in your mind are the parallels between Jackson and Trump that make Jackson now an iconic figure for Trump followers?
Sure. On one side, you've got, of course, all the scandals in terms of marriage, extramarital. Those things were going on in both administrations. And Trump, obviously, when it comes to morality and sexuality, he's kind of off the scale. But the other thing that I think shows that there's connectedness, not just their Scottish background, but also the fact that each of them is a very unusual president. That is, they really don't fit the norm. They are outsiders who came in and really did challenge a lot of assumptions in Washington, D.C. I can speak better on Jackson than I can on Trump, but I mean, certainly Jackson was very feared in Washington, D.C., not just because he was brutal, and he was, but also because he really was willing to call something, and when he thought it was wrong, he was very open about that, and he did change. I mean, there were a lot of drastic changes in Washington during his two terms.
Well, Jackson, in his right after his inaugural, his inaugural party was at the White House, and he basically opened the doors and said anybody can come in. And in fact, people came in and they stole pieces of the White House. It was widely viewed as sort of a raucous time, shall we say. Trump comes into office on the same kind of populist rhetoric. I'm here for you. I'm here for the little guy. But then he doesn't let the people in. And in fact, to get into any of his inaugural balls, you have to be a high-end donor. He fills his cabinet with lobbyists, which is, quite different than what Jackson did. He surrounds himself and funds himself with billionaires. He himself is a billionaire. Andrew Jackson wasn't, although his wealth increased. I think you could make a strong case that virtually 100% of Andrew Jackson's wealth was a result of being a slave owner. Doesn't that, with any kind of close look, doesn't that comparison break down quite quickly?
Yeah, probably. I think that, you know, and it's not something I dwelt upon at all in the book, just making a note that certainly Trump, when he came into office and then on the 250th anniversary of Jackson's birth, that he really did celebrate that. And it was an interesting speech that Trump gave that day. So, yeah, that's the real connection. I think just the fact that they one is interested in the other.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. The book is in Defense of Andrew Jackson. Bradley Berzer is the author. The book is out now. Bradberzer.com is his website. Brad, thanks a lot for dropping by today.
Oh, thank you, Tom. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Good talking with you. And, you know, fascinating topic. We'll be back. It's coming up on 17 minutes past the hour. There's a lot in the news we'll be getting to, and your calls and thoughts right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, that was interesting. I was fully expecting a, we'll see. I was fully expecting a debate, and instead I got a conversation. Stick around. Welcome back. 17 minutes past the hour. Our phone lines are open. Our telephone number, 202-808-9925. Feel free to give us a shout. Are you keeping track of what's going on with Paul Manafort? I think, you know, this is not being brought up in the media, but basically I think that the way that this is playing out is that Manafort is basically advertising. I think he's trying to use the media to say to Donald Trump, if you're going to give me a pardon, it better be now or never, because I'm going to save my butt. I think Paul Manafort, he's at the point now, he's been convicted of enough felonies that he's going to spend the rest of his life in prison. If they concatenate, you know, they could give him some leniency, but they could also literally keep him in prison for the rest of his life. And those are the small ones, right? The treason against your country kind of stuff is what's coming up next. And Manafort, you know, the news story is, well, Manafort is thinking about cutting a deal maybe with these people and maybe not, and we'll see. But he's trying not to involve the president in the deal that he's cutting. I don't know why nobody else is calling this out and pointing this out. What Manafort is saying is, time to give me a pardon or not. If you don't want me to spill to the other side, if you know, Manafort is saying that if Trump doesn't want him to spill his guts, spill the beans on all the crimes that he knows that Donald Trump is involved with. And keep in mind, Paul Manafort lived in Trump Tower for years and years. Paul Manafort ran Donald Trump's campaign. Paul Manafort was an advisor to Donald Trump. He's a longtime friend of Donald Trump. And Paul Manafort goes way back in Republican circles. He worked peripherally with Nixon. He worked directly with Ronald Reagan. His company came up with the Willie Horton ads in the George Herbert Walker Bush election of 1988. The Willie Horton ads against Michael Dukakis. You know, these racist ads. That was Paul Manafort and you know, the people who worked for him. And so Manafort is, you know, the Republican Party has largely dumped him. And now I think I think this is an absolute Hail Mary. And we'll see where it goes. Meanwhile, Beto O'Rourke is, this is interesting. Trump's personal lawyers have a joint defense agreement with Manafort. This is Tierney Sneed writing at TPM. President Trump's personal legal team has a joint defense agreement with Paul Manafort's lawyers, allowing them to share confidential information, according to Rudy Giuliani. That's really interesting. He had similar agreements in place with both Mike Flynn and Michael Cohen before those, in both cases, those joint defense agreements broke down. And, you know, Trump stands alone. It'll be real interesting to see if this thing gets maintained. He's now facing money laundering and failure to disclose foreign lobbying charges. And again, here at the news story, Manafort has been resisting prosecutors' desire that a plea deal include cooperation. I'm telling you, this is Paul Manafort's way of saying to Donald Trump via the media, you better be giving me a pardon or I'm going to be spilling the beans. So we'll see where it goes. We'll be picking up your calls right after this. It's 21 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program.
Home of the Pollution.
We'll be right back. Tom Harbin here with you. And Donald Trump is working to suppress the vote in North Carolina using monstrous new methods. This, the Independent Media Institute's Stephen Rosenfeld writing about this. I think we should get this guy on as a guest. This is really extraordinary what's going on and all the details with this. Paul Manafort, I was talking about this in, for just briefly during the break here. I'm seeing all these news reports about Paul Manafort saying, I'm willing to cut a deal with the prosecutor, but I don't want to throw Donald Trump under the bus. Right? I'm willing to do a plea agreement, but I don't want it to be a cooperation agreement. I'm willing to say I'm sorry, but I'm not willing to give you Trump. Yet. And in my opinion, what this is a loud and naked shout out to Donald Trump saying, hey, Donald, you either get me out of this mess with a pardon or I'm going to have to flip on you because I'm looking at life in prison right now, given my age. And I think that that's exactly what's going on. And it's going to be real interesting to see how Trump handles that. JP in Bozeman, Montana, listening on Sirius XM. Hey, JP, what's up?
Not much. How are you doing, Tom?
Great. What's up?
I was just thinking, Trump has declared war on the press and claims it's the enemy of the people. What's preventing him and for us supporting him to break up those liberal media monopolies? It seems like it's within his power to lead the charge on breaking up media monopolies that are obviously destroying our democracy.
Well, I'm not sure it would destroy our democracy to incrementally do that. For example, to go back to the rule saying that the networks can't own stations. And
well, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying that we should lean into his
use his talking points
and say,
but his talking points are dishonest. I mean, you know, there's this thing, right. The fruit of the poison tree. If you're using dishonest talking points, even for a noble outcome, I'm not sure that you can reliably believe that that outcome is gonna be a good one.
You don't need to say that you agree with it. You can just say, if the media is doing these things, then whether they are or they aren't, it's obvious that it's a media monopoly. Let's break those monopolies up. And if you're right, then you know you're right.
Yeah, you know what's real interesting in this area. Is back in the 2012 election? Was that the one where Howard Dean ran, or was that 2008?
2004.
Wow. Okay. Whichever one it was, Louise and I remember this as if it was yesterday. It was just so shocking to me. Louise and I were sitting on the couch watching TV, and Howard Dean was being interviewed by Chris Matthews and on MSNBC. And Chris said, what do you want to do about the media? And I have no idea what and by the way, this is from memory, so these may not be verbatim quotes, but I think they're pretty close. And I didn't know what he meant at that moment. I didn't know, did he mean, whatever. And Howard Dean said, break them up. And Matthews was like, break them up? And Dean was like, yeah, these big companies are too big. They're doing too many different things. And Chris Matthews said, you mean like break up NBC, the network that you're on right here? And Howard Dean was like, yes, break up the big networks. And it was 2 days later that the Dean scream happened, which we all know now in retrospect was not any sort of weird event. Howard Dean just said, yeah, into a microphone, but it didn't, the microphone was the kind of microphone that blocks out crowd noise. It was perfectly normal what he was doing, but all the networks turned Howard Dean into a crazy person. And so that's what happens to politicians who publicly call for the networks to be broken up, in my opinion. JP, thanks for the call. I do think that competition is a good thing, and I think that local control is a good thing, whether it's in the media or whether it's, you know, a company making computers. And just right across the board, we have gotten too big.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
We'll be back. It's 27 minutes past the hour. Back with your calls right after this. It's a once-in-a-lifetime luxury Alaskan cruise on the Regent Seven Sea Mariner, July 24th, 2019. For more information, Keen Luxury Travel, 800-856-1155. And did I mention, we'll be getting active on board with special events with yours truly, me, as we visit Ketchikan, Juneau, Skagway, Sitka, Hubbard Glacier, and Anchorage. Well, it looks like that thing that is so common with Republican politicians getting caught with, I don't think I can say that one on the radio. Getting caught with their pants down, shall we say. Brett Kavanaugh, apparently a woman has written a letter to Representative Anna Eshoo, a Democrat in California, who turned that letter over to Dianne Feinstein, who shared it with Chuck Grassley, and now they are referring this to the entire Judiciary Committee. Feinstein said in a statement today, "I have received information from an individual concerning the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. That individual strongly requested anonymity, declined to come forward or press the matter further, and I have honored that decision. I have, however, referred the matter to federal investigative authorities." So this is now apparently in the hands of the FBI. You know, Brett Kavanaugh, he's the lawyer's lawyer, right? For example, a Democratic senator sends him a written letter that says, how did you pay off the $200,000 in credit card debt? You referenced, losing money in a dice game in one of your emails. Have you ever played a game of chance? You know, and have you ever declared winnings or losings from gambling to the IRS? And Kavanaugh says, no, I've never declared anything to the IRS, and I've never played fantasy football. What? That doesn't answer the questions. You know, that's like, you know, hey, have you ever shoplifted? I have never stolen lettuce from Safeway. You know, I've stolen wine from the wine store. It's like, come on. That's amazing. Paul in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind?
I'd just like to rebut the author that you just had on. As far as the genocide that was a major part of Jackson's agenda back during his presidency, there's not enough whitewash to make that intellectual house that's falling down look like anything but a fixer-upper.
Yeah, his book is published by Regenery, which is the right-wing publishing company that publishes Jerome Corsi's books, like, you know, Swift Boat Veterans for Truth.
Like the Boers did in South Africa, you know, they picked and choose winners and losers, and with their superior technology, they made the losers really lose, calling it genocide.
Yeah.
And to look the other way and say that was okay is not okay. You got to pull the shine off of that one. But I'd like to say that to square the circle, to make it the final points about these arguments, you have to look at who Trump apprenticed under, Roy Cohn.
Yeah.
The man who made civil rights and social justice in this country look like a totally unattainable kind of a thing because of his torn-up personality, the thing that happened to him as youth.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a bizarre logic that these people follow and that the Trump followers follow as well.
Don't look at what I do, but just listen to what I say and take it to the bank.
Because well, it even goes.
Follow me is to the bank. If you look anywhere else, you'll come up there.
Yeah, it even goes a step beyond that, and that is that hey, let's destroy a group of people, right? Whether it's Native Americans on a reservation or whether it's African Americans in downtown Flint, Michigan. Let's destroy a group of people. Let's give them crappy water. Let's give them terrible schools. Let's underfund all of their infrastructure needs. Let's deny them health care. Let's do all these things. And then when their community is in crisis, Let's stand around and say, see, told you those Indians couldn't do anything. See, I told you those black people couldn't do anything. You know, and then you get these guys coming on network television. Literally, you see this about once a week, particularly over on Fox so-called news, saying, well, it's another black-controlled city that's in a crisis. You know, wink, wink, nod, nod to all the racists. And, you know, nobody ever asked, well, how did it get that way? It's the same thing with many of the countries in Africa that suffered under hundreds of years of colonial rule and were, you know, essentially raped, you know, stripped of all their resources and absolutely prevented from ever developing any kind of democratic norms. And then people go, oh, why doesn't that work? Oh, it must be the color of their skin. Come on, give me a break. Paul.
I think your voice is a strong one in pulling some of these things together. Dot-to-dot kind of things that people who actually want to look and not swallow the Kool-Aid can follow and come up with an alternate plan, because there's many, many alternate plans that don't take the extremist route, the race to the bottom.
Yeah. But that, you know, what I just described that they do with black cities or black countries is the exact same thing that they've been doing for centuries. I mean, this is and it's just as much a lie now as it always was. Paul, thanks a lot for the call. Very, very well said. Bill in Sebastian, Florida. Hey, Bill, what's up? You wanted to talk about Kavanaugh?
Yeah, he did seem quite evasive the entire time he was.
And have you read the written answers to the questions? I mean, they're sleazy, slimy, slick. Phew.
He's just and the $200,000 that he couldn't account for, and his avoidance was just you could just see that the man was teetering on falsehoods the entire time he was in front of the Senate.
Yeah,
that's all I've got.
Okay,
really.
Well,
DeSantis down here has really taken a turn to the right with some of the supporters he's taken on, and I believe that's going to hurt his candidacy tremendously down here in Florida.
Yeah.
So thank you very much, Tom.
Well, I hope you're right, Bill. I really hope you're right. What in the ads DeSantis is running, what are the things that he's saying that cause you to think he's been taking a hard turn to the right?
Well, just the people he's associated with. What's his name? Who just got back from Brazil. The fellow they threw out of the White House.
Steve Bannon?
Yeah, Bannon. Bannon just got on board with him.
Oh, geez.
So, yeah, right. And as well as, I believe, endorsements from that fellow Spencer as well.
Yeah, Richard Spencer. I didn't know that Spencer had endorsed him. Richard Spencer is the modern face of the American, neo-Nazi movement, essentially.
Yeah, well, this guy, DeSantis, is trouble, and he's terribly shallow.
Yeah.
Terribly shallow on the issues. You know, he's got those go after you ads against the fellas in Tallahassee.
Yeah.
The ex-mayor, or the mayor of Tallahassee.
Yeah.
But that's all I've got, Tom, so thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome. Mr. Gillum has, represents a great alternative. Charlie in New Harmony, Indiana. Hey, Charlie, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I love your show. The blue wave is on the way. Believe it, man.
Hopefully.
My question is kind of a rhetorical thing, and it's speaking about an election in 2012. And God knows I wouldn't have done it then, but wouldn't we have been better off if Mitt Romney would have won then? Look to the future, what that would have done for 2016. Just as a thinking point here.
I don't think so. Mitt Romney would not have put Kagan and Sotomayor on the Supreme Court. Mitt Romney was, in my opinion, and still is, by the way, he's going to be the senator from Utah soon, and then he's going to be running for president in 2020, is a wolf in sheep's clothing. He binds himself closely to the economic agenda of the Republican Party, which is basically support the billionaire class at all expense. And tries to put a friendly face on it. You know, he's got this oh shucks thing down really, really well. I'm just very, very concerned. No matter how decent a Republican is, they're still a Republican. They're still part of a giant machine. Well, here, for example, since Citizens United, this is over at Common Dreams today, Jessica Corbett writing about it. Since Citizens United, just 15 groups account for 75% of the $800 million in dark money spent on U.S. elections. That, you know, 75% of $800 million came from just 15 groups, and virtually all of them are hard right wing. U.S. Chamber of Commerce is number one at $120 million. Crossroads GPS, that's Karl Rove's group, at $110 million. American for Prosperity, that's the Koch brothers, $59 million. The National Rifle Association, $54 million. The American Future Fund, I'm not sure what that is. The American Action Network. League of Conservation Voters, well, okay, that's, you know, there's $30 million. National Association of Realtors. And then it gets into, you know, the groups that are just pushing for their own interests. But this is how this happens. And you know, Mitt Romney is going to be one of the people who's going to just totally embrace those guys, in my humble opinion, Charlie.
Yeah, I failed to consider the Supreme Court thing, which is really bad considering what's going on now.
Yeah.
But you're right. He probably would have had four more years to work with the Congress and ran through these tax cuts and kill Obamacare. And yeah, but it's just, oh, it's what happened is so bad. I wouldn't even consider that maybe have been better than what happened. But man, yeah. What's happened? Jeez.
Well, that's the thing. Donald Trump is taking his Andrew Jackson impersonation way too far. And, this is not a good thing for America. Charlie, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. We're going to check in with Talk Media News in about 4 minutes and find out what's going on in the world today. We'll be back after that or for that. So stick around. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be right back with more of your calls, and we're going to check in with Talk Media News in just a moment. And welcome back. Kenyatta in Redlands, California, watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, Kenyatta, what's on your mind today?
Very succinct if I can be, because I never know when you're going to come up on a hard break, and I know you've got something coming up.
We have 4 minutes.
I wanted to tell you, or express to you, and you may be a little surprised, but hear me out on this one. I think I wanted to tell you about why I think Donald Trump is a genius, and in an idiot savant kind of way,
mm-hmm.
and why I love Donald Trump, and it is as follows. Donald Trump is a genius because he is clearly a megalomaniac. He clearly is a sociopath. He clearly is narcissistic to a degree that I've never seen before. However, he's a genius in that he has a way of branding things, whether it be Crooked Hillary, Crazy Bernie, Failing Times newspaper. He has a way, and this stuff sticks. And Donald Trump, whatever you think about him, Donald Trump is successful, and Donald Trump speaks to the majority of the American people, because Donald Trump knows that he's an idiot talking to idiots.
I would say he's talking to the majority of white men. I don't think he's talking to any other majority in this country.
That's a distinction without a difference, Tom. He's an idiot talking to idiots.
Okay.
And he speaks idiot, and he is very successful that way. He is a guy that everything is dominated by him since he's been in office. All the news stations, it's Trump all day, every day. It's almost like, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but it is weird. The very thing that the country is doing, the media in particular, constantly talking about Donald Trump is the very thing that he's after. And the thing that would need to be done to bring him down is the thing that the media won't do. And I understand why. It's sexy. So that's the genius in him. And here briefly is why I love Donald Trump. Barack and Michelle Obama were a lie. They were kumbaya. We've gotten past racism. We've gotten past slavery. Look, we've got a black man, which we constantly talked about his white mother, by the way, and not his black father, who was a professor and that he loved, wrote a book about. We constantly talked about that. Because we have overcome. But the reality is that that was a lie. Donald Trump is the real America. Donald Trump is a racist. He's a pig, he's a sexist, and he represents what this country really is, and that's why I love him.
Hmm. Why would you love him for that? I don't get it.
Because he represents reality, Tom. He's the reality that me, as a black man at 56 years old, have lived every day of my life. And a well-educated one, by the way. I'm not the stereotypical, you know, downtrodden, oh, blah, 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 blah. You know, the stories that they tell about us black people all the time. No, I'm not that. In fact, my first vote was for Ronald Reagan. I learned better. But the point is that he, this is what this country is. And it's only a shock to white people now.
Yeah.
Donald Trump is not the disease. He is the symptom.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with you on that. And you know, I've said it a couple of times. It looks like Susan Sarandon, as much as I strongly oppose the idea of voting green, and I campaigned aggressively for Hillary Clinton once she won the nomination, Susan Sarandon's thought that if we had Donald Trump as president, it would be such a shock to the system, there'd be a revolution, may turn out to be prescient. We'll see. Now, it's not the way that it should have gone. It's not the way I think any of us wanted it to go, but here we are. Kenyatta, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. We'll be right back. Let's check in with Talk Media News and find out what's going on in the world today. This report brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. And Loving What You Do, a new book by Ellen Ratner. On the line with us is Bob Ney, the author of Sideswiped, former Republican congressman from Ohio. Congressman, welcome back.
Well, thank you, Tom.
So it's always so nice to talk with you, Bob. I always learn so much. What's at the top of your hit parade in terms of the news today?
Oh, you're so kind. But I learn a lot from you. I love your show. I listen to it.
Thank you.
Well, I'm not going to say Donald Trump's name first. How about that?
Okay.
I'm going to say Betsy DeVos.
Oh, yeah.
She works for Donald Trump, all right?
Yeah.
And, you know, she's, of course, the Secretary of Education, and she's lost a lawsuit, and that was accusing the department of delaying, inappropriately, accusing them of delaying the implementation of a borrower defense rule that protected students. Now, of course, this was a rule that was brought during the implementation in the Obama-era regulations. It was meant to protect students who took out loans to attend college from predatory practices. And by the way, the suit was brought by 19 states and the District of Columbia. And, of course, it went through the federal system, and a Washington federal court judge on Wednesday ruled that the department's postponement of this borrower defense rule was procedurally improper.
Let me just get this straight, Bob. Betsy DeVos has been arguing in court against 19 states in the District of Columbia that regulating the student loan business with regard to predatory practices, that stopping predatory banking corporations from ripping off students, stopping that is a bad thing, that we should simply let predatory loan practices go on. Is that the position she was taking?
Absolutely. That's absolutely, and not only did she take it, she helped to stop the Obama-era regulation rule. Wow. She made sure it wasn't implemented. It was a rule during his time as president.
So has the court forced her to put the rule into place?
Oh, absolutely, because what they're doing, you know, these were revelations that some, and they have cases here,
right.
Some for-profit colleges entice students with promises for education and diplomas, and they would not allow them to get jobs in their chosen fields. It was a sham. So those certifications weren't recognized.
Yeah. So
So the department deprived plaintiffs of several concrete benefits.
DeVos loses. The court says you must protect students who are borrowers.
Right.
And is she going to take this to the Supreme Court, where Brett Kavanaugh, if he's on the court at the time, will probably be the fifth vote to say screw the students?
Well, I mean, that could be a potential, because this judge, Randolph Moss, wrote a 57-page opinion, and he said the relief that they seek in this action, immediate implementation of the defense bar regulations, would restore benefits. And he said, because maybe he suspicions what you just said, he said in writing that he didn't want to delay matters further, and he's going to hold a hearing Friday to consider remedies.
Mm-hmm.
So not only has this judge went with the 19 states and District of Columbia against her, he's going to hold a hearing Friday to try to institute remedies, because he probably suspicions that they're going to try to take this up, you know, to the food chain, to the Supreme Court. This is pretty serious. I mean, these were not allegations. This happened, and the Obama-era regulations corrected it.
Remarkable. What else is up, Bob?
Unreal. Well, you know, they're talking about the blue wave, and I think this is pretty fascinating when you look at all of the data out there. And you look at the numbers, 1,706 Democratic congressional candidates have spent or raised money during this current cycle. So that breaks the previous record set in 2010 when 1,688 Republican candidates registered with the FEC. And we, of course, know about the Tea Party wave and what happened with that.
Sure.
So on the Democratic side, this is a great blue wave, but it does get boiled down to, with this headline that we read today on all this, though, what President Obama has been stating over and over and over, which is, you know, you can be upset and you can wring your hands or gnash your teeth, whatever you want to do, or complain about Donald Trump, but it's a great statistic that is out here for a potential blue wave, but unless the voter turnout occurs in November, then there's a problem.
Yeah.
If the voter turnout is in November, then these statistics, I think, probably bode pretty well.
Right, with only one out of four eligible voters under the age of 25 showing up to vote right now, we've got a major crisis in this country, and young people in particular need to get activated. They need to make sure that they're registered to vote. They need to get out there to vote. And even in, like Michigan has made it almost impossible for students to vote. You have to vote at your parents', home. And so, you know, if you're going to school in Lansing and you live in the Upper Peninsula, you've got to drive hundreds of miles, hours and hours, just to vote. But still, do it. I mean, you know, and get Democrats in there who will change those laws. Forgive the rant, Bob. Back to you. What's going on? What else is in the news?
You're right. The statistics look good if the voter turnout occurs. And, of course, the committee vote is scheduled now. It was on an 11-10 party line vote for Kavanaugh, and that will be 1:45 p.m. on September the 20th. There's still a lot of back and forth, but that's when it's scheduled.
So they're going to vote on it next week?
Oh, yeah. They're going to cut it off September the 20th.
Wow.
Committee vote.
Wow. Okay, Bob Ney, the author of Sideswiped with TalkMediaNews.com. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, Bob.
Great talking with you. So we'll be back with more of the news of the day and your calls right after this. Do you think, you know, Paul Manafort is shopping a pardon? And do you think that Trump is going to win this thing?
You're listening to Tom Hartman.